Good morning, everybody. Good to see everybody. Please come in. After last week's share on environmentalism, we're moving into another field, not completely unrelated, because we are going to be talking about science. And I'd like for the next few shiurim to talk about certain scientific and technological issues. We haven't really dealt with those over the last 76 shiurim, but there's plenty to talk about. So I'd like to take a few weeks on those issues. And I'd like to start with a topic which is really divided into two parts, part one today and part two next week, please God, which is a rather tricky subject of science and chazal. How do we view some of the things that we see written in the Gemara in light of modern-day scientific understanding? And we'll see a number of these examples today. But it sometimes happens that we read in the Gemara and other sources from the rabbis, from Chazal, the rabbis of the Gemara and the Mishnah of the Gemara, Talmudic period, we read certain statements on medical issues, on scientific issues, on cosmological issues, and they just don't match with what we understand to be clearly scientifically true. How do we deal with that? Because obviously we have something of a conflict here, and we need to find out different ways to resolve it. The conflict is very clear. The conflict is that on the one hand, we want to be faithful to our tradition, and there is a mitzvah of emunat chachamim, that we believe very much that our rabbis were not just another group of individuals, but they were highly attuned, very spiritually elevated people who were able to reveal truths in a way that we're not able to access without them. That's for sure. That's, if you like, one aspect of the equation. On the other hand, we live in a world which seems to be empirical and based on scientific facts. If anyone wanted to tell you now that the sun orbits around the Earth rather than the other way around, then we don't really have any time for that. It doesn't. And we send rockets constantly all around the solar system, which are based on the facts and the science that the Earth orbits around the sun, and no one's going to convince anyone otherwise, I don't think. How do we put those two things together? Because Chazal clearly, well, we'll see if it's clear, but Chazal seems to clearly understand, as everybody did, that indeed the sun orbited around the Earth. That was a classic Ptolemaic understanding of the universe. What do we do with those things? So today I want to use as a paradigm case a rather itchy subject, which is the one of light. I'm sorry, I won't talk about light for very long. We're going to go on a mystery tour around so many different areas of Shulchan Aruch today that by the time you finish, you'll have forgotten all about the light, don't worry. The lights are, if you like, the paradigm case where this comes up. Because when the rabbis discuss the issue of killing light on Shabbos, they make a very interesting observation. Look in number one, please, and let's start with it. The rabbis say, the Gemara says in Shabbos as follows, the Tanya Rabbi Lezer Oymer, ha-hoyrei kina b'Shabbat. If you kill a louse on Shabbat, ga-hoyrei gamal b'Shabbat. It's as if you killed a camel on Shabbat. Meaning, I don't care if it's a tiny, tiny little louse, it's killing, and killing is killing. It's one of the 39 malachot. You could kill something small, you could kill something big as a camel. It's the same. You've broken Shabbat on a Torah level, and you are liable accordingly. The Gemara challenges that. Matkiv la Rav Yosef. Rav Yosef challenged that. Ad kan loy pligi rabbon aleya der b'liyeza ela b'kina. The only issue is with a louse, with light. De ein upara barava. They don't do pru-revu. Lice don't have sexual reproduction. That's why there's a debate here. But on other creatures, other shkatsim, other flies and things of that nature, creepy crawlers, they agree that you're liable for killing. But on the issue of lice, apparently there is a debate. Whereas Rabbi Eliezer said, if you kill a louse on Shabbat, that is exactly the same as killing any other animal. The rabbis, the chachamim, disagree. And they say no. Killing lice on Shabbat is not prohibited. Why? Because lice don't do pru revu. We'll see what they thought they did do. Amalei Abaya, and the Abaya answers, for kina ain't a part of Rama. Really? The kinim not do pru revu. The ha'amar, isn't there a statement? Ha'amar, Yoshev HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'zan. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sits and he sustains the world. Mika'arnei revin. From the horns of the karnei revin, the greatest sea creatures. Ad beitzei kinim, until the eggs of lice. Oh, says the Gemara, if lice have eggs, then there must be mummy lice and daddy lice to make the eggs. Okay? So Gemara answers, no, minahu, this is not eggs at all. It is a certain kind of tiny, tiny species, demikri, which is called betekinin, light eggs. But it's not the eggs of light, it's something that has the name light eggs, it's another creature. In fact, there are no light eggs because there is no pru revu with light, say the Chachamim. So here you see a machlokes in the Gemara between Rabbi Eliezer, who clearly understands that light are like regular creatures, and the rabbis, the majority that says that light are not. How do we paskin? We paskin like the rabbis, like the majority. The lights do not do pru revu, and you can kill them on Shabbos. Look at the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch was written 1,000 years after the Gemara. The Gemara obviously is the 4th, 5th century. The rabbis the Shulchan Aruch is in the 15th century, 16th century early. Perush, a flea. Talks about fleas. Otelit Sodor, you're not allowed to trap fleas on Shabbos. Elaim Kain Hu Al Basaron, unless it's actually on your skin of Oxfam and is biting you. Then you can drop it to stop yourself getting bitten. Aval Kina, sorry, but also Horla Horago, but you can't kill fleas. You're not allowed to kill fleas. Aval Kina, the light says the Shulchan Aruch, Mutala Haraga. You're allowed to kill a louse. No problem. So the Shulchan Aruch repeats that din 1,000 years after the Gemara and says you're still allowed to kill life, even today. The Mishnah Brura, who is 500 years after the Shulchan Aruch, and is now in the 20th century, early 20th century, repeats that din exactly and explains why it is. Number three, after Laharga, why are you not allowed to kill a flea? Hatam, the Machalkim Bein Perush Lekina, why do we make a distinction between fleas and lice, he says. You'll be itching all over by the time we finish this one, okay? The Kol Malachas of Shabbos, Mimishkan Yalfilam, that all the Malachas on Shabbos are learned from the Mishkan. And we learn the idea of shchita as one of the 39 halachas from when they have to kill certain kinds of rams in order to get the skins, shahayu b'mishkan, which they used in the mishkan, b'shvil arosayim, they needed their skin. The lav davka al yidei shchita, not only killing by shchita, which is how they kill those rams for the skin, dehu adin al yidei hakar, even if you hit the animal, the chanika, or strangle the animal, or nechira, or stab the animal, the kolki agavna, or any way you would kill an animal on Shabbos, kivan shiba al yidei zan, etilas neshama, chayim. If you are going to end up killing the animal, no matter how you do it, doesn't matter if it's shchita or some other means, that is chayim, you are breaking Shabbos. Now, what about life? We say just like the rams that they killed for the skin, sheparim v'ravim, that they do pru revu. There are male and female goats and rams and sheep, etc. Ask kol sheparim v'ravim. So too, only animals which do pru revu are included in this category of the prohibition of killing on Shabbos. La'afuke kinah. This excludes a louse. De'einu ba mizachom and a keva. He says it very clearly. Lice do not come from males and females. El ba min hadzeya. They come from sweat. Okay? Therefore, lo chashiva bria. They are not considered a creature because they are not produced like regular creatures. Aval perush, but a flea, afapi shegam hi einu parabarava. A flea also is spontaneously generated. That's the expression. We'll use that more in a minute. Fleas also come from sweat, but Bikol Mokam gives other reasons why fleas are dealt more seriously in a little bit more seriously in halacha, and you're not allowed to kill them. But lice, and for that matter fleas, he says, spontaneously generate. They are not created by pru urvu. Now, this was a very common understanding in the ancient world, clearly in the world of the Gemara. Why do people think this? No, just do an experiment. Take a piece of meat, clean it, and wash it under a tap, leave it outside for a couple of days in the sun, and look and see what's happened. It's crawling. It's crawling with maggots and lice. Where did they come from? You could watch it for days on end, very intently. You didn't see anything walk into it to lay any eggs. The eggs just appear. They spontaneously generate. And that was the understanding of all scientists all through the ages until around the 18th century. If you just turn to the very back of the sheet, just for a second, I brought you an appendix, which was taken from an interesting website, which calls this article The Slow Death of Spontaneous Generation. And it explained that through the 16, 17, 1800s, I'm not going to read this, you could read it in your own time, there was a gradual erosion of this assumption that there was such a thing as spontaneous generation. And eventually the one who laid rest to this idea was Louis Pasteur, people began to think that maybe they were microorganisms that you couldn't see in the air. And in fact, there were things laying eggs on the meat, but you just couldn't see them without a microscope. And of course, what Louis Pasteur did, he did a famous experiment that he created a vacuum. He took all the air out of two flasks. He created a vacuum which he sealed in one flask, and in the other flask he allowed air back in, and of course in the flask with the vacuum, no microorganisms grew because there was nothing there. And therefore, he concluded there is no such thing as spontaneous generation. And that is, as far as I'm aware, the scientific orthodoxy that there is no such thing as spontaneous generation. Everything comes from somewhere else, nothing comes from sweat. And therefore, go back to the halakha. What are we going to do with this now? And this is not just a theoretical, philosophical question. This is a practical question. 3 days from now is Shabbos. Am I allowed to take a louse out of someone's hair and squash it on Shabbos and kill it? Or is that an issur d'oraisa on Shabbos? That's a very big question. Anyone who's dealt with children in warm countries will know that lice are fairly endemic. What can I do? Can I kill it or can I not kill it? This is a very big machlokas. It seems from the Gemara, it's very clear, and from the Shulchan Aruch and from the Mishnah Berurah, yes, I can. I can kill the louse, no problem. So what are we going to do about this? How are we going to resolve this problem? So I want to bring you 8 different ways to resolve the problem. 3 of them today and 5 of them next week. I cannot possibly do all of them in one day. Let me set up today and give you 3 approaches. And hopefully next time we will finish the other 5. The first 3 approaches go like this. One approach, which is suggested by some of the posting, which is, of course you cannot kill lice today. You can't. That's prohibited, perhaps even on a Torah level. But doesn't it say in the Gemara that you could kill lice? Different lice. They're talking about lice that did spontaneously generate, and today we have lice that don't spontaneously generate, and therefore you can't kill them. And Chazal are also correct. Problem solved. So, that's a logical answer. It's a logical answer. And it may even be plausible that the lice in the time of Chazal maybe were a different species. That's 1,500 years ago, 5,000 miles away, whatever. Maybe you could make that argument. You could maybe try to disprove it, but it's a bit weak, but maybe. But what about the Shulchan Aruch? 500 years ago. What about the Mishnah Berurah living only 90 years ago in Russia? Are you really going to suggest that the lice that existed in Russia are a different kind of spontaneously generated species than the lice we have today? Not really. That's not really going to work. And therefore, I think even though there are those that suggest this, it starts to look weaker as we get more towards modern times. A second answer, which we're going to spend much more time on, is the concept of Mishaneh HaTeva. And this we have to take very seriously, because it is discussed across the board. Now, quite coincidentally, this really wasn't planned. I'm actually giving a shiur after this in Beit Knesset HaNasi, I'm speaking 3 weeks of there, where I'm actually talking very specifically about Mishaneh HaTeva, and giving lots of sources on this issue. Today, I'm just going to go through some of the questions, and give you a few sources. If you're interested in a more source-based analysis of that, then you can catch that share online, or you can go and listen to it in Beit Knesset HaNasi afterwards, whatever suits you best. But there is a concept of Nishtameh HaTeva. What does Nishtameh HaTeva mean? It doesn't mean that they have different life than we have. It means that life has changed. Things have changed. Nature has changed. It used to work this way, and that's what Chazal observed, but now it doesn't work this way anymore. Now, you may decide at the very beginning of this whole discussion that you're not going to buy that and that lice have not changed biologically over the last 1600 years, and maybe that's the case. But we do need to look at Nishtameh HaTeva as a concept. Where are Chazal getting this from? So let me give you around 20 different ways that Nishtameh HaTeva comes up. And I'm just going to give you today the Rosh Prakim, just the outline of these issues. And again, if you want more details, then there will be a share that you can go to online. Let's talk about various different things in which you'll see in some cases, it does make sense that there's something called Mishtameh HaTeva. Things really do work differently today. And we don't know exactly necessarily why things change, but things have changed. And because they have changed, maybe the halakha would change with them. Let me give you some examples. Hargasha, and they're from all over the halakhic system. What is Hargasha? Literally, Hargish means to feel something. Hargasha is a concept in Hilchot Nida. When a woman becomes a Nida, then two things, according to the Gemara, have to happen. First of all, blood has to leave the uterus and cross the cervix. That is part of the process of becoming a Nida. But also, the woman has to actually feel something internally happening. There has to be a Hargasha for that to actually be real Nida. And the Gemara recalls as a matter of fact that women felt something happening as a Hargasha inside them when their menstrual cycle started, when they began to bleed. Now, that was one of the halakhic requirements for making somebody, you know, classifying something as a Nida. Now, over the centuries, and certainly you can ask people today, most people today say they don't feel anything anymore. Of course, there is still blood that gets, that comes out of the system, the uterus, but people don't say that they feel anything. People say, no, I don't know what I felt. The first thing I knew, I saw that there was something coming out, but I didn't feel anything. So what does that mean? Does that mean that, oh, nobody today is a Nida d'oraita? Which would be a very major halakhic statement to say, because, well, if you didn't feel it, then you didn't tick that box, you didn't check that box, that's not called Nida, you have to feel it, and it has to come out. Or do we say, no, Nishane Hateva, meaning women used to have that feeling, but now for whatever reason they don't. Teva has changed, and therefore they are still Nida because we don't need that anymore. The halakha has changed with the changing of the Teva. Now you can argue, why don't women feel that anymore? Is it because, you know, of what we eat and our lifestyles? Is it because we're all so stressed? Is it because we drink too much Diet Coke? I've no idea. You know, I've no idea, and I'm not going to speculate. But one thing is for sure, people say they used to feel it, and today they don't feel it. Something has changed. On a related issue, and this is very, very striking, vest kavua. This is a very, again, in Hilchas Nida, an important halakhic concept. What is a vest kavua? The idea of vestet, okay, a vestet. Well, vestet as in the vestet kavua, okay, vestet kavua. The idea of a vestet is that there is a period of time, hence the concept of the name period, between one the onset of one menstrual cycle and the next. And that vestet is a fixed period in some women. They can time it, says the Gemara, not just to the day, but to the hour of the day, and predict it with absolute certainty. And that has important halakhic ramifications, because there is a halakhic obligation for the couple to separate before she is expecting her next period. And if she knows when it's going to be, then they can work with clockwork. Absolutely. If she doesn't know when it's going to be, then it's much more hit and miss, and she has to guess a little bit, and there are different halakhic ways to try and anticipate, maybe this, maybe that, but it's a different kind of arrangement. The Gemara takes it as axiomatic that most women have a vestet kavua. They do. And again, that's not the kind of thing that the rabbis are going to make up. They are going to ask people, and they're going to be told, this is how it works, and they base the halakha on that, which gives a significant leniency. If you have a vestet kavua, then you know that this is when you're expecting, and therefore the day before or whatever is going to be up to that point, is going to be fine. Already by the time of the shach, the Shulchan Aruch recalls Chazal and says, yes, vest kavua, this is how it works. The Shach turns around and says, today, meaning in the 17th century, women can maybe predict the day, but not the hour of the day. The Poskim today say, no, people can't predict anything. It's all very surprising these days. Things don't work like clockwork anymore. And that changes the halacha. So again, something did change there. There is a nishtaneh hateva. Something changed. And again, I don't know what changed exactly, but whatever changed made a change to the halakha. Let's look at another example, and then before I brought you a source here. Tanu Rabbanan, ben shiv'a b'chalal alav ha'shabbat. If a baby is born 7 months gestated, you are obligated to break Shabbat to save the baby's life once the baby is born. Uben shmaina, a baby born 8 months gestated, ein b'chalal alav ha'shabbat. You are not allowed to break Shabbat to save that baby's life, says the Gemara. Safek ben shiv'a, safek ben shmona. I'm not sure whether it's a 7 month gestated or an 8. Ein mechalel nevas shabbat. I can't break Shabbat for it. Ben shmona, and if I know it is an 8 month gestated, harihu ke'eved. It is no different from a stone, and therefore the baby, says the Gemara, is muksa. The asur letaltama. You can't even move it. Very harsh. Aval imoy socher. The mother can nurse the baby Mipnei ha-sakana, because of danger, to the mother, not to the baby. Because the mother needs to nurse, it's important for her health, and therefore we allow the mother to nurse this baby, but as far as we're concerned, the baby is finished. There is no chance. This was an observable phenomenon that they saw at the time, that they felt that a baby at 8 months gestation just would not survive. 9 months, yes. 7 months, yes. But 8 months, no. And they based this halacha on that. Today, that is clearly not our experience. The vast majority of babies born at 8 months survive. And now, is that because something in nature changed? Is that just because we have new technology that enables us to save the babies, incubators, etc.? May not be exactly Nishtani Hatseva, but for sure something has changed. And if you look in any halachic sefer from the 20th century, you will see even Toistless in the Middle Ages were uncomfortable with this halakha and trying to find ways to allow you to work with an 8-month baby and saying, well, maybe it's an 8, maybe it's a 9, we can never be quite sure, etc. But today, if you look it up in Shmiras Shabbos Kilchasa, he will rule very clearly, a baby born, however premature, needs to be saved. And we can save babies now, even wait for 8 months, 7 months, even sometimes 6 months, as long as the baby is basically held but just premature. So this halacha has changed, no question about it, because something in nature changed. Unless you say that Chazal didn't really understand what was 8 months and what was 9 months and what was 7 months, we'll get more to that next week. Next week I want to deal with the question as to maybe Chazal just didn't know science. And is that some kind of heretical statement, or does that fit in some way? That's a little bit more controversial, that's for next week. But for now, let's continue with Nishtani HaTeva. Brit Mila, looking number 5. The Gemara writes in the Shulchan Aruch rules, Bizman Chachmei Gemara. In the times of the Gemara, Im Loi Haya Rochatzin Et HaYelet, Et HaVlad, sorry. If you didn't wash the baby, Lifnei HaMila, Ula Acha HaMila, Ubiyom Shlishi LeMila, on the day before the Mila, and after the Mila, and on the third day after the Mila, the Mayim Chamim, Hayam Asukha. Chazal understood that babies needed a hot bath before, after, and 3 days after the Mila, and you were obligated to break Shabbos, to cook hot water, to boil hot water, to bathe the baby. The Ha'idna, but nowadays, interesting change. Nowadays, he says, Loi nagu b'rechit seklal. We don't wash babies at all in hot water before and after Bris Mila. V'dina rechot b'shabbat zimrotsu, kedin rechit seklal. And now a baby has the same din as any other person that might want to have a hot bath on Shabbos. Obviously, if they're a chayla, there are certain heterim on a rabbinic level, but not on a Torah level. They wouldn't be allowed to just go and boil a kettle and make hot water for a baby. Back in the time of Chazal, apparently they were, because there was an understanding that that was needed for the baby. Very interestingly, something seems to have changed over that period. Then they did need it, now they don't need it. Let's talk about another example. Go over to page 3, and we'll zip through some of these quite quickly. When women become pregnant, so Chazal understood that they did menstruate during the first 3 months of their pregnancy. And therefore they are required to expect, halachically, that they will expect a monthly period for the first 3 months during pregnancy. And therefore the halacha flows from that accordingly, that they have to be prepared for that, separate from their husbands, etc. Before, just before. However, for the 24 months that they nurse children, after birth, Chazal said, no, she's never going to see anything there, and she can assume that there is going to be no monthly cycle at all. And they based the halacha on that too. And again, that's not something which is based on an ancient understanding of science, and maybe they didn't understand this or did. No, this is a clearly observable phenomenon. Chazal would just speak to the women and say, what happens? Well, when we're pregnant, we do still menstruate. And when we're nursing, we don't. And the halacha is based on that. Now, today, we seem to have the opposite experience. Most women, when they become pregnant, immediately stop menstruating. That's one of the first indications that they might be pregnant. And on the other hand, when they're nursing, it's not at all uncommon for women to expect a monthly cycle. So what happens? Does the halacha stay the way it was? And we say, no, this is how Chazal said it. During pregnancy, you do expect, during nursing, you don't. Or do we say, Nishtane Hatheva? And Moshe Feinstein says, we're inclined to say, Nishtane Hatheva. And now during pregnancy, maybe you don't expect, and during nursing, you should. Which will, of course, during nursing, be a chumrah to say that even though Chazal said you don't need to worry about it, maybe today we do. This seems to be incontrovertibly something that has changed over the period of time. And there I think it seems very reasonable to say that something changed. Again, what changed? A lot has changed. Don't forget, you know, the onset of puberty has radically changed, even on the last, in the last 200 years. From 1718 down to 1112 sometimes. Things have changed. And menopause has changed. And lots of things have changed. For all sorts of reasons, this seems to be something that's changed as well. On a completely different topic, Chazal say the best time to eat fish is just before it goes off, when it's almost rotten. Okay? And Tosfos come in and say, excuse me, but like, we don't do this. The worst time to eat fish is when it's going off. And he says, maybe, you know, they're talking about different fish. That could easily be. Or maybe just Nishtane HaTzeder. Cooking fish and meat together. The Chasam Sofer draws attention to the fact that the Rambam seems to be very lenient on cooking fish and meat in the same oven, in the same, at the same time, etc. And he asks why. Don't Chazal say that there is a problem, it's dangerous to have meat and fish mixed together. It's not like meat and milk. It's not like Basar B'Chalav where it's not dangerous, it's a halachic issue. With meat and fish, there is a danger issue, which we're sometimes even stricter on. The Chasam Sofer raises the question and says, why is the Rambam apparently lenient? And he concludes, Nishtane HaTeva. Meaning we're not going to eat meat and fish together because we have a clear established minhag not to. But maybe we can be more lenient about their being cooked together because if it was dangerous at the time of Chazal, maybe it's less dangerous now. And the Rambam was a doctor. He should know about these things. And therefore maybe that's why he was lenient, because of Nishtane HaTeva, things have changed. My main time, the Shulchan Aruch brings it in, that if you eat meat in the meal and you wish to eat fish, you must go and do Netilas Yadayim. We are familiar with Mayim Rishonim and Mayim Achronim, washing before the meal and washing after, before benching. But who here is familiar with Mayim Emtsayim? Who was here and seen people jump up from the table and say, we've got to go wash now because we've had fish and we're going to have meat. Now, what we do in our house is we serve whiskey between the fish and the meat. And when we don't have fish, we serve whiskey as a zecher, so when we did have fish, between the fish and the meat. So either way we serve whiskey. But nobody goes to do mine and sign. And again, the Meforshim, the Magen Avraham, only 100 years after the Shulchan Aruch, says that we don't really do this anymore, and maybe we're going to say Nishtane HaTeva. Now, again, it's a little bit far-fetched to say that something changed in those 100 years between the Shulchan Aruch and the Magen Avraham. Presumably, he's just looking at this issue of Nishtane HaTeva differently and saying we're more likely to change the halacha because of Nishtane HaTeva. Maybe the Shulchan Aruch feels we're less likely. What's that? There was. Yes. They call it Yain Sarov. Anyway, maybe not Glenn Linnet. I'll give you that. But they certainly have something. Let's skip one. Let's go to Yibum. Yibum's a very interesting example. Yibum still applies in the sense that if a woman is married and her husband dies and has no children, the woman is obligated to do chalitza. Back in the day they used to do Yibum, and there are still some Sephardi authorities that would allow Yibum, meaning marrying the brother-in-law, which is very unusual if you think about it, because a brother-in-law is normally one of the arayot. It's normally one of the sexually prohibited relationships, incest. But with a Yibum situation, you're allowed to marry the brother-in-law. We don't do that today. We do chalitza. But chalitza can be difficult. And certainly, a couple of hundred years ago, when there may be a brother living at the other side of the world, and effectively, if the woman needed to do chalitza, she would be an aguna. There's no way that she's going to be able to get from Minsk down to, Rome to find the brother and do chalitza. So she's stuck. What if the husband dies and she's pregnant? So then we have to wait and see. And if indeed she has a baby, there is no chalitza. What if she has a baby and the baby unfortunately dies a couple of months later? Okay, she had a baby. She had a baby, the husband left the child, and unfortunately the child died. There's no chalitza. What if she has a premature baby? One of these 8-month babies? Does that count as a baby? An 8-month gestated baby, and then that baby dies? Do we turn around and say, yes, she had a viable child, and the child unfortunately dies, therefore she doesn't need to do chalitza? Or do we say, no, I'm sorry, this child never really was ever viable, because Chazal say that the child cannot live, and therefore the fact the child was born and then died, she still needs to do chalitza, there was no child here. There can be enormous implications on that, and there we see a machlokas again. Some poskim say, the child lived, and nowadays 8-month-old child lives,
Mishnah HaTeva, and some say no, we have to stick with Chazal and we don't count that at all. Sakanat Eva, just go down to M at the bottom. The idea of losing a limb on Shabbos. Chazal is very clear that you're only allowed to break Shabbos if there's a danger to life. Sakanat Nefashot. What if there's Sakanat Ebel? Meaning the doctors say, well, we think you'll live, but you'll never use your arm again. There was, God forbid, an accident. So there, Chazal is very clear, the halacha is very clear, that you can't break Shabbos for that. You cannot, there's a lot you can do, but you cannot break Shabbos for Sakanat Eva alone. Today, all the poskim will say that Sakanat Eva is potentially Sakanat Nefashot. And therefore, if somebody is in danger of losing a limb, they need to treat that, at least in the initial stages, as Sakanat Nefashot, and they have to go and get it checked out. Now again, what changed? Were people just hardier back in the day? Well, people were hardier back in the day. Yeah. And they could live and survive and prosper even with serious damage. And today we're all basically very weak. Maybe. In which case, that's Nishane Hateva. Let's look at a few final examples and then we'll get to the third approach. The famous one, which needs a shear in of itself, is the eggs versus the fetus. The famous one where we're coming up to Pesach. Pesach is only about, how long? 6 weeks away? Something like that, maybe a touch more, maybe a little bit more, not much more, maybe 7 weeks away. There's the perennial question, which is why, when we need to eat a kazayas of matra. And a kazayas is an olive. And I have an olive tree, and I know how big the olives are. The olives are this big, and the volume size of an olive would come out to so much matra. Why are we then eating a piece of matra that looks like this? Okay? And one of the factors involved in this is the fact that Chazal gives two different ways to measure the volume of a kazayas and a kebetza. One is based on eggs, and one is based on sums, a volume of cubic volume based on sums. And when you do those measurements today, they do not come out to be the same anymore. Today, it looks like the sum volume is much bigger than the egg volume. So you can either say that people's sums have got much bigger, and back in the day they had little sums, and now people are big with big sums, or you can say that the eggs have got much smaller, and back in the day they had big eggs, and now they have small eggs. Now, which one of these you go with is a whole shir in of itself. But either way, something changed. Nishtame HaTeva, which has had a difference, made a difference to the halacha. By the way, the halacha assumes, the Noda Yehuda famously assumes that sums cannot have got bigger because we believe in a concept of Yuridus HaDoros, that everything gets lower and smaller through the generations, which is fascinating because that's a Hashkafic idea, really, in terms of spirituality, but he says it can't be that people are bigger than they used to be, must be that their eggs are smaller than they used to be, and every time it says an egg, we have to double it, which is where we end up getting bigger shiurim. In fact, it's interesting that it seems to us, based on archaeology, etc., that people are much bigger today. You only need to go into a castle from the Middle Ages and realize every time you go through the door, you have to crouch down because people routinely were much smaller. Does that mean indeed that the thumbs are much bigger today? That is not a discussion for now because it's a bigger issue. But either way, something's changed. The final couple of cases. Metzitza. This is a controversial one we need to maybe have a share on as well. Why is there such a thing as metzitza, where the moil during a brit milah has to actually extract, has to suck a little bit of blood out of the wound before they can bandage it up and make all the brachas? And Chazal are very, very clear. This is because of the sakana. They're very worried that if you don't extract some of the blood from the wound, there may be something left in. It may be dangerous to the baby. It's to save the baby. They're very clear about it. And the doctors today say, there's no need for it. There's no purpose to it. And what happens if indeed you do the mitzitza and it could endanger the baby? Because there may be a danger of communicable disease between the mole and the baby. So do you turn around and say, well, Chazal clearly had a reason for this, but today the reason doesn't apply, Nishtane HaTeva, or do you say, no, this is a halacha, and on this one, the poskim, pretty much all of them insist, in fact, all of them really, that the tisa is required. Now, whether you use a kli, whether you don't use a kli, that's a whole different discussion, which is not for now, but there, again, something seems to have changed, but the halacha in that sense has not changed. Also, other areas where Chazal said the baby is yellow, you can't do the bris. The doctors might say, we don't see a problem with you doing a bris. We won't do the bris. Even though the doctors say that it's quite safe to do the bris, because if Chazal gave us certain signs as to when you can and can't do a bris, then we will not do the bris. A couple of other examples, and then we'll move on.
Similar to the Matita angle, which may be something based on Halacha Lemoshe Mitzinai, is the Simane Trefas. And this is, again, each one of these is a separate share. What are the Simane Trefas? Chazal gave us a number of different Simanim, a sign to know when an animal is sick to the point that it cannot survive 12 months. And if the animal cannot survive 12 months, then it's Trefa. It's a Trefa, and you cannot eat it. So if you look at this list of diseases that Chazal give, very different anatomical anomalies and a hole here and a discount. Many animals that have these diseases today live quite happily for years and years and years. And the question is, well, what do we do with that? Chazal told us that this animal is treif, and yet we see in front of our eyes animals walking around with these diseases years later. So do we turn around and say, well, we have to change that now, and the animal is no longer treif because clearly it can survive, or do we say no? This is a list of trefas from Chazal. These are halacha l'moshe misina, the halacha won't change. But either way, nishtami hateva, something seems to be different. Other things as well, I brought you some anatomical ones, bovine anatomy and animal gestation, even male anatomy. At the end there, I brought you a quote from an Art Scroll Gemara that you can read on your own. Chazal were absolutely confident that in the male anatomy, there were two different vessels, one which brings the urine and one which brings the semen, and they're two different things. And that is not the case. Do you say that nishame hateva, meaning people used to be designed like this, and now they're designed like that, and there, even though there are posts that want to suggest that, most posts will say, well, that's just too far-fetched. There's no way that people have evolved, or devolved, or whatever else you want to call it, or changed, in that period of time, of 1,000 years, that they now have a different anatomy. That's just not even possible. And therefore, there are limits to how far you can take nishtane hateva. And hopefully you've seen there are some cases where clearly something has changed. Incontrovertibly, the facts on the ground have changed, and therefore maybe halacha needs to change. Some cases it's more far-fetched. So what are we going to say about the life? Let's get back to the life. So I'll leave you to work out whether you feel nishtane hateva is a viable option or not, but at least you've seen a little sort of skirt through some of the areas in which nishtane hateva is used. Let's move on to the last thing I want to deal with, which is important for today, which is a very important approach that science brings. Chazal brings, yeah.
Before you leave that, it seems to me you haven't answered the fundamental question.
Which is?
Well, it seems to me that in all these cases, there has to a greater or less extent been Islamic.
Yes.
In some cases, they've changed the halakha.
Yes.
In some cases, they haven't.
Yes.
How do you know?
How do you differentiate? So, it's not entirely clear to me, because I'm not an expert on this, but one thing which seems clear, I gave you some further reading, if you're interested in footnote 6, I gave you 7 different references to articles and websites and various different things which you can go on and read about Mishnah Hateva. One guideline seems to be the following, that if the poskim classifies something as halacha l'moshe mitzinai, as in the case of the Simani Trefas, or in the case of Matita, then no amount of nishtane hateva will change the halacha, because that halacha, if you like, is grounded in a clear masora from Sinai. And the nature of people or the world is not going to change that. But where the halacha was developed in response to Chazal's understanding of the circumstances, okay, then maybe if the circumstances change, then that understanding changes and the halacha will change with it. That's one guideline I can give you, which seems pretty clear. But you're right, we have to really go into this in more depth and work out why Dafke here, yes, not there. When I go on to give the shiur in an hour from now, I'll be talking about that in more detail in that next session. But let's look at the last area, which I think some of you may be a little bit irritated by this, but that's fine. That's not a bad thing to get a little bit worked up. Next time, as I say, we're going to look at the mirror opposite of this. Solution 3 is, look, it's not different life. And nothing's changed. It's just that the scientists are wrong. And Chazal are right. And that's all you need to say. Now, as I said to you, solution 4 next week is going to flip that and say, well, maybe Chazal are wrong and the scientists are right. And let's see what we do with that. But for now, let's look at solution number 3 and see. This is a very sourced solution. Let me show you on the issue of the light. When this first came up, there was a tshuva of Rav Yehuda Brill. We're looking in Italy in the 18th century. Look at number 8. Ein l'shanot hadinim hamiyusadim al kabbalat kadmoneinu. You may not change any halacha which is based on a mesorah from our earlier authorities. Bishvil chakirat chachmei umat ha'olam. because of scientific investigation for non-Jewish sciences. Ein Zurich, the Jewish or non-Jewish scientists, but at the time there really weren't any Jewish scientists, so let's say it would apply to all sciences. Ein Zurich lemaamin levakesh mimakom acher. A person who believes in Torah does not need to go looking from any other place. Rayot v'chanot, proofs and arguments, afal pi sheyeshnam rabot v'atzumot, I don't care how strong they are, or how many they are, ki tatzpik kabbalat rabotei. For us, the Kabbalah of our rabbis is enough. The inkein, ein lazuz mimash nitzak al pi gemarateinu, we may not, and he's talking about life here, we may not budge from what our Gemara rules. Afilu kol ruchas hachakiras ha'enoshiv sheba'olam baz v'noshvas bo. Even if all the winds of human science will blow against us, ki ruach Hashem diber bano. Because we have a greater ruach than their ruach, the ruach Hashem is within us. Achei, therefore, chasel dat hachoker. The scientists just really don't get it, he says. Ve'ein tichlo magia la'omek chochmat ha'teva. They don't really understand nature properly, which by the way may have been an accurate statement in the 18th century. It was only in 1915 that doctors started saving more people than they were killing by intervening. Okay? And therefore, maybe his analysis of science in the 18th century was not far from the mark, but again, what would that be today? He says, they only see things superficially. Because it's very, very deep. They don't know, the non-Jewish scientists, they don't realize it. Even the non-Jewish wise men. They only see in the shachiut, the superficial way. And in a way that appears to their eyes. Not in the inner way. Our people, our rabbis who are experts in Kabbalistic ideas, Maaseh Bereishis, and whatever Maaseh Bereishis is, they understood more deeply, and therefore, and don't forget, what he's arguing for here is a leniency in Hilchos Shabbos. He's telling you, you go kill that louse, and don't think twice about it. Kill it, and you're not liable for anything, because the Gemara says it's okay. He's not trying to be strict. He's trying to be halakhically lenient, but in a way which is, if you like, hashkafically, very straight down the path and saying the rabbis are the rabbis and that's who we follow. The Chidah, similarly, number 9, similar period, just after, he said, V'nimshach lezeh v'omi ki hinei hayu min ha-gedoil, and there were great people in our own nation, she'ala al-da'atam, that they thought to themselves, lintot k'tat midivri chazal v'stagma, to depart from chazal. And who he's talking about, we'll see next week. The Rambam, of Avram and a Rambam, etc. They rejected certain approaches of Chazal. They were experts in natural sciences, I think you'd call it. But Dafam Rachava Vasavru, ki Chazal hayu chachamim levad, and they held that the rabbis were rabbis, but they, these new modern people, he says, and again, he's talking about the Rambam, are rabbis and scientists, and therefore they're able to judge better. V'zeh tam sha'amru halot gam banu chochma v'da'at, im sheheim chachamim yoter. Aval habalei l'sum l'divan, they should have thought to themselves, ki chazal hay alehem ruach ha-kodesh. Chazal were not just white people, they had ruach ha-kodesh. V'eliyahu zachor l'tov shchiach gabayu. And they were visited by Eliyahu Anovi. V'nishmatam mimakom elyon, their neshamas came from a high place. V'hinikiyah, and were very pure. V'ein yachas beinehim lebein chazal. These rabbis that are talking against Chazal, they can't even compare to Chazal. Utrichim anu lechof rasheni, we have to bow our head, ulekabel ha'emet mi ba'alei ha'emet. And receive emet from the ba'alei ha'emet. And he's, again, firing here at the Rambam. By the way, the context of this piece in the Chidah is when he's talking about certain halachas where certain gedolei ha'poskim appealed to Eliyahu Hanavi, or some Kabbalistic intervention, or Magidim, or Malachim, or voices, which itself is a whole shir, and he justifies that. He says, our people have not just their own minds, but they have input from above. Remember, there is one of the Baalei HaTosfos, Rav Yaakov Mimarei, I think it was Yaakov Mimarei, Shalit and Shuvah's Min HaShamayim, where he goes into a trance, and he goes up to Shamayim in his trance, and he asks a number of questions on halachic things that bother him. And he comes down, he writes them down in a book. How legitimate is that as a halachic venture to go into a trance and ask questions to the heavenly host?
And that's the whole debate in and of itself. It's very interesting as to what kind of things he asked. If you had the opportunity to go to the heavenly host and ask questions in halacha, what would you ask? Because what he asked, very interesting, he's very bothered apparently by Maim Acharonim after benching, before benching. He's very bothered by whether women should say a bracha when they shake a lulav, which by the way he says they should, which was interesting. But anyway, that's a separate discussion. But the Chidah says that our rabbis have access to this as well. In fact, he's basing this on a Gemara, looking number 10, Amar Mar Zutra, greater Rav Nachman, Rav Nachman. Rav Mar Zutra says to Rav Nachman, Heichi Dami Podgura. What does Podgura feel like? Now, Podgura is, I think, what we today call gout. Okay. What does gout feel like? So Rav Nachman answered him, Amalei, Kemechet the Basar Hachan. It's like someone sticking a needle in your live skin. It's horrible. So the Gemara says, Minayada. How does he know? He's a rabbi. How does he know what gout feels like? And he gives three answers. Ikad Amri Mechash Havichashbei. Someone say, he had gout. So who better to tell it what it feels like than him? So that's one answer. Ikad Amri Mirabei Shmalei. And other people say that he had this he didn't have gout himself, but people who had gout had told him what it felt like, and he understood that. The Ikad Amri, and a third option is Sayyid Hashem Lireah. That God speaks in secret to those who fear him, okay? And therefore, the rabbis have access to a higher level of truth through their mystical Kabbalistic connection. Therefore, this is a real approach which is taken, not just in the world of the Rishonim, but if you look here at number 11, Rav Moshe Sternbuch, Shlita, who was the head of the Eidah Haredit, a very prominent spokesperson, very outspoken in many ways. Look at what he writes in 2005. However, what we can't understand, we rely on our faith. It is obvious that man's thoughts are not comparable to God's in the ability to understand nature. Similarly, we acknowledge that we can't comprehend or adequately explain God's ways concerning good and evil in each generation. The things we don't understand, he says. In these issues, we simply rely on our faith in God's greatness. In contrast, they, talking about the scientists, prefer to explain that man is the product of millions of years of development. As evidence, they cite what appear to be ancient bone fragments that have been discovered in Madagascar and other places. Their evidence is total nonsense, since prior to the flood, man lived for 1,000 years. This difference in what was normal growth and development makes the bones appear as if they were millions of years old. With this type of shaky evidence, they want to refute the words of our sages and undermine the faith that exists among the Jewish people. Their main concern is to shake the faith in God, which has been accepted by us generation after generation. They want to replace this faith with the acceptance that events are determined primarily by the laws of nature. Scientists, even those who are described as religious, are ashamed that we don't agree with the views of leading scientists that man is descended from the apes. They rush to find isolated statements of our sages, rabbis, and commentaries that seem consistent with the contemporary scientific view. Therefore, they use misleading and distorted citations from federal literature to claim justification for such scientific beliefs in the words of the sages. That's quite outspoken. Some of the context here was this was around about the time when Rabbi Slitkin had his whole brouhaha, I think he would call it, and there was a lot of discussion at that time about Torah and science. Very interestingly, I've been teaching Baalei Tshuva and young people since I left the law and came to Israel in 2002. So I've been teaching people really for the last 15 years since 2003. Around this period of time, people were very interested in this. People were interested in the age of the universe and evolution, which is something we're also going to talk a little bit about. This is a real hot button topic, young people. I talk about this to young people today in 2018. They look at me with glazed eyes. They're just not interested. And when I first discovered this a couple of years ago, I think, are you not bothered by this? Not really. They're completely different kind of concerns affect the generation of young people today that affected people 20 years ago. It's very, very interesting. And I'm trying to get them all kind of worked up and say, you know, this is a real issue. No, it's not. It's much more of an issue as to, you know, whether my parents treat me nicely or don't treat me nicely or whatever it is. And there are other issues that bother them. But this Rav Moshe Sternbuch comes out very strongly. He makes a few points there. What does he say? He says he thinks science is shaky, which is an interesting question, because science, there's different kinds of science.
In, for example, the statement that the world is round and not flat is a different kind of scientific statement to everything in the universe came from inorganic matter, turned into organic matter, and then evolved into the world that we have today. They're two very different kinds of scientific statements, and we can talk a little bit more about that on another occasion. He also alleges that there's a scientific agenda, an anti-religious agenda, which may be true in certain situations. I mean, if you read the writings of Richard Dawkins, then you'll see very clearly that there is a clearly anti-religious agenda. He's very blatant and open about it. He's a militant atheist. But does that mean every scientist is anti-religious? Is it conscious or subconscious in different places? And again, at the end, interestingly, he says, the rabbis who try to fit science with Torah, and there's a whole genre of literature of this, people like, Aviezer, Nathan Aviezer, and Schroeder, Gerald Schroeder, and the people who, again, about 20 years ago were writing all these books. I'd be interested to know whether people are still buying those books and what people are, but they were very interesting books. He claims distortions. They're taking things out of context, they're twisting things to fit Torah, to fit science, and it's not true and it's not accurate, and therefore he comes out very strongly. And it's, again, not just him. He's based on other things. Look at two more sources before we wrap up. Have a look in the Rashba, in number 12. The Rashba is dealing with somebody who claims that they have a sheep. They have a shepherd that lived longer than 12 months, even though it had one of the demonic traits. And the Rashba is very unhappy with this person. Look what he says in number 12. The Rashba is living, in Spain in the 14th century. 13th, 14th century. He says as follows. V'chein, v'kan anasholim oistas shemi'id. We're going to ask this guy who is giving testimony, She'ein ata yodea sha'afazo. Do you really know that this animal lived this long? Shema shachachta. Maybe you forgot something. Or shema ta'ita. Maybe you made a mistake. Or shema nitchalef l'cha b'zman. Maybe you got the time mixed up. Or shema nitchalef l'cha b'heimah. Zob acheret. Maybe the sheep is not the same sheep that you were studying and surveying all along. She'i esh la'eh she'tehei b'heimah zo bein eina kol shema b'chodesh. Are you telling me that you were watching this little sheep, Dolly, or whatever her name was, for all 12 months? You slept next to the sheep and you never let her out of your sight. You can tell me with absolute certainty that this is the same sheep? I don't think so, he says. Ve'im yitchazek b'tagutot. And if this man insists on this mistake by saying the sheep lived longer than 12 months, for your man, he says, no, lo, ki ahavti dvarim zarim. I like weird stuff. I did sleep with the sheep in the pen and watch it for 12 months. I'm an unusual individual, and that's exactly what I did do. Ve'hem asher ra'u einehem ba'achreihem eilech, and I'm going to go according to what we saw. Ne'mar, are we going to say to this man, lo'hoisi lad al divri chachami yesha? Don't you dare speak Russian horror against Chazal, says the Rashbam. And I'm going to just ignore this person and 1,000 like him. The alti batel nukuda achas, rather than write out or erase one little point, the mashi iskima b'chach miyitzra v'hakadoshim ha'neviim u'bnei neviim u'dvaram she'nemu l'moshi mitzinai. Because our Torah comes from chachamim and neviim and God himself. And therefore I don't care if you tell me that you've been watching that sheep for a year without a break. You're wrong. You have to be wrong. Because it can't be. Because Chazal said it can't be. Very, very hurry.
We'll get there.
But the Rashbam, you can see, I'm just bringing you this approach right now. The Rivash says a very similar thing. He says that this approach is dangerous, and is denying Torah Mitzinai. If you start to question and raise issues on what Chazal say on scientific issues. Let's just leave it with a slightly skeptical note from Rav Moshe Feinstein, and then I'll give you an introduction to what we look at next week. Look at number 14. Rav Moshe Feinstein looks at this Rashba and says, not sure. Af la'achashi yishtanu hafvim, and he goes back to Nishtanu hateva. He says, look, things really have changed. V'yuchru lichyot gam v'lo rufuot. Even without medication, these animals can live long lengths of time with these diseases, because Chazal said they couldn't. Kamoshe Elohim, as people see, V'yodin kol ha'olam kula. Says Rav Moshe, you just can't live in denial. You can see it in front of your eyes. These animals live. V'leikem azeh shum kvira v'divrei ha'mishnah. And I don't think this is kfira. I don't think it's kfira to say, heresy, to say that there are indeed animals that live longer than Chazal said he could. Da'ad rabba, mitkain de bezeh divri ha-mishnah, we can actually uphold the words of the Mishnah in the Gemara, shelo yiksha alayhu me'amatsiyas, shebedoris acharonim. And say that, look, the Matsiyas has changed, and nishtane ha-teva, etc. And then he says a very interesting thing. I don't know if the Rashba would agree with this. She'af ha-Rashba, even the Rashba himself, im hayachai, if he was alive today, V'chein asa shehu ba'olam ha'emes, and not only that, even now, when he's in Olam Haba, in the Olam ha'emes, began Eden, Maida, he's got to agree, he says, sheyesh miktsav me'ela shemanu b'mishnah b'gemara, that there are examples of the animals that they include in the Mishnah b'gemara, sheheim traitors, which are meant to be traits, sheichulim yifo, and they can live. In fact, he brings himself, he said, I'm going to put myself on the line. The Rashba is standing in Shemayim now, looking down, saying, Maskil, I agree. Okay? It's a very broad thing to say. But Rav Moshe Feinstein had broad shoulders. So where does that leave us? It leaves us halfway through a very important discussion, I think, which is, what do we do with science and Chazal? So approach number one is, we just say that, look, they were talking about different things completely, which in some cases will work, in other cases won't. Then we talked about Nishtane HaTeva, which is that maybe things have changed. And I think from that list we saw, I think it's clear that some things clearly have changed. Why exactly, I'll leave you to think about. And some things have not changed. And as the gentleman said over there, we have to work out where we're going to change the halacha and where we're not going to change the halacha, and work out a path through this. And the third approach, which is very strong and which you'll see repeated in many situations, many places, I can send you to many people's homes, many senior avonim around the world today who will mirror what Rav Moshe Sternberg said, that we're not interested in science, science is wrong, and Chazal are right, and the halacha is the way that Chazal said it. There are at least five more approaches, which I want to talk about next time. And they include the following. Number one, like I mentioned before, they call it number four. Okay? Maybe science is right and Chazal are wrong on scientific issues. How does that affect the concept of Emunas Chachamim, to say that the rabbis were great spiritual geniuses, tied to Sinai in so many important ways, but on science, they just reflected what people thought at the time, okay? And that's the best they could do, and they tried to help as they could, but we don't have to stick with that, those approaches. Can we say that? And by the way, nobody today would advocate following the medical advice of Chazal. If you go to any rabbi in the world with a medical complaint and say, but look, it says in the Gemara that this is what I should do, they'll say, forget that, check yourself into the emergency room and get them to advise what to do. Why will they say that? What happened to all these very strong statements about Chazal? So we'll talk about that next week. We also need to look at the possibility that Chazal and science are going down two completely parallel tracks, and they're not interfacing really at all. And one's talking about this, and one's talking about that. That's a very important idea. We need to deal with the question next week as well, as to maybe there is such a thing as a download of 2,000 years of Torah. This idea that there was that the world is divided into three lots of 2,000 years. 2,000 years of Torah Bavol, 2,000 years of Torah, and 2,000 years of potential Mashiach. Maybe halacha is defined by those 2,000 years. And I don't care what the science is now. The scientists are right. Kol hakavod to the scientists, absolutely. But it's irrelevant, because halacha is defined only in that window. And we'll see that as well. And then we need to look at some other more exciting answers to other Chazal, talking about deeper things, and whether actually they may have been looking forward further than we thought. But that's for next week. Today let's leave it there, and I'll leave you a little bit on the Shvilkas, and we'll talk about the rest next week when we see. Have a wonderful week.